Okay. Today is an introduction to what might be an occasional ongoing series. So if anyone would like to follow it up, that's great. Are there women in the Bible? Yes, and lots of them. And hopefully you've just found some. The Dictionary of Bible Women tells me there are 205 women named in the Bible, which amazed me, and I thought I knew a fair few of the women in the Bible. And they'd identified over 600 mentioned but unnamed women in the Bible. So this very patriarchal text has over 800 women in there. So we should be able to find them. How many do you know? In the Gospels, there are 15 women named between the four Gospels, so the ratio seems to drop back a bit. Nine of those are probably figures known in the early church because they went on to be leaders or known figures, including five Marys. Women in Bible stories are often sidelined, but not always. And even those that have really significant roles have often been sidelined by the church. A friend of mine some years back now did a PhD looking at the text omitted from the common lectionary, which we don't use, but many churches do. And often the reading will stop before the story of the woman. And she did a PhD looking at the women deliberately omitted from the lectionary. Why is there no parallel sermon on men in the Bible? Perhaps because the male character is often seen as normative, the representative of human, while the women characters are seen as other and often ignored. Stories of women are often then read in brackets, and I'm using Anne Thurston's word, a sense of this is a story about women, this is niche interest, this is not a story for all of us. And Anne Thurston says it's important that we take away the brackets when we read stories about women. If the characters were men or if the gender roles were reversed, would we read their significance differently? And I've previously at some point here read the story of Mary and Martha as the story of James and John to illustrate that. Because then it becomes not about a domestic disagreement, but a story about discipleship. Reading for women is often about reading for who is not there, which means reading imaginatively, means reading in the gaps, like the prodigal son's mother, what Phyllis Bird calls a host of unnamed mothers who, silent and unacknowledged, bear all the endless genealogies of males. And what does it do to us if we read the mothering of all those genealogies? It's a different way to read those genealogies. Somebody raised each of those men. Seeking the women in the Bible means standing in a different place to read. Not necessarily a better place, but another legitimate place to read from. That has long been passed over. And the question really for today is, what do we see when we look from a different place? Now, the topic was given to me to speak on because one week when we were discussing Moses, I said something about the women in his infancy narratives, and someone said, oh, you should talk more about that. And as we've looked at Moses in depth over the last couple months, I thought having a look at the women in Moses' birthing and infancy stories might be a useful example and way into thinking about the women we haven't seen, because this is a story we've just all spent time with. Exodus chapters 1 to 14 takes us from setting the scene of the Israelites captive in Egypt through to crossing the Red Sea. And in those 14 chapters, they are packed with characters. It's a very character-intense story. But only seven of those characters are given a name. And three of the seven are women. I could do a spot test to see if you could tell me who they are, but Zipporah has been mentioned today, the wife of Moses, is one of those three. Miriam is actually not named. Miriam is in the sister of Moses is in those stories, but she's not called Miriam until they've crossed the sea later. The pharaohs are not named. The captains of the army are not named. But Shiphrah and Puah are named, who are the two midwives who refuse the order of genocide from the pharaoh. For the record, the four men are Moses, Aaron, Moses' father, Jethro, and Moses' son, Gershom. That's all the men that get a name. And naming is very significant. If somebody is named, it's a flag to say, this person we think matters for some reason. Which is, I'm sure, why Peter knew that Job's daughters were named, because Job's sons are not named, but at the very end of Job, his three daughters are named. His second family, three daughters. So we have Egypt under a tyrant pharaoh who has been stirring the people to hatred of their alien, inverted commas, alien neighbours, so that the Egyptian people are spontaneously vilifying their neighbours, which sounds like 100 contemporary settings we know of how a civil war or a social movement, a nasty social movement, gets going. That's the scenario of the Egyptian situation and the Israelites. And into that hate and fear-filled culture, the pharaoh decides on a policy of genocide. But rather than sending death squads, the pharaoh decides to send midwives. Now, the horror of that is really quite abhorrent, that those whose very profession is to bring life are charged by the pharaoh to kill the boys. It's not clear if the midwives are Egyptian women serving the Hebrews or if they're Hebrew women. That's ambiguous. I tend to lean towards them being Egyptian women whose profession is serving the Hebrew women. But they choose not to obey. They simply ignore the command. They just go away and don't do it. They were completely entitled to the Nuremberg defence of being following orders. They had an audience supposedly with Pharaoh himself, who directed them to kill off the boys, and they chose not to. They stood up to the oppressor, and they stood up to the majority voice of their culture, and they chose to act with mercy rather than with hatred and rather than out of the fear of the culture. And they risked their very lives to do it. So the pharaoh calls them back and asks them why they've disobeyed. Now this is the point at which you really expect them to be killed, because they have disobeyed a significant order from their pharaoh, who's already been illustrated as being a paranoid tyrant. This is not a rational leader. The response they give almost certainly comes out of women's stories, because they invent a lie that the Hebrew women give birth too quickly and we can't get there. They're too quick for midwives to be present. And this is a joke on men who've never witnessed a birth. Especially royal men who were likely to be particularly insulated from the realities of childbirth. If you lived in a small, poor hut, you might still have access to childbirth, even if you weren't in the room, but the pharaoh, fairly likely, had never been anywhere near it. But it's the sort of joke that works in women's culture, because women know, that doesn't work in male culture, and somehow it's got into our text. Shiphrah and Puah, and they probably represent a larger group, but they've been named representatively, save the Hebrew people from annihilation. Now, the story of the Exodus is one of the key, in many ways, it's the key story of the redemptive history of Israel prior to Jesus. And it begins with Shiphrah and Puah saving the people from being wiped out. And we don't know their names. We don't even remember that they're there. That they were named in the text indicates that the people at the time recognised how very important they were. And it's said at verse 21 of Exodus chapter 1 that they were rewarded by God making them households, which is an unusual term, and it's not quite clear what that means, whether they were given children of their own, or, this is what I lean towards, that perhaps the Egyptians recognised, sorry, perhaps the Hebrews recognised these Egyptian women as full members, households within the Israelite society, as an honour to them saving their people. The same phrase, to make a household of, is the phrase that's used around David and Solomon when they're setting up the Davidic dynasty, that God will make a household of David, and it means setting up that whole royal line that becomes so important. These women are made households of as a reward for their actions. This is a truly remarkable story that we just don't see, because we expect a story about Moses, and so we get a story about Moses. And the story goes on being significantly progressed by women. Moses' mother hides him for 3 months and finds a way to put him in a sealed basket in the river, technically fulfilling the requirement of the law that the boys be thrown in the river, but managing to do it in a way that keeps him alive. Moses' sister watches and intercedes and very cleverly manages to get Moses' own mother into the palace as his midwife, as his wet nurse. And then Pharaoh's daughter enters the scene. And Pharaoh's daughter, remarkably, you would expect someone from the palace coming and finding a Hebrew boy. It's very clear she knows he's a Hebrew boy. In a culture of fear and hatred of Hebrews, her own father, being the instigator of this genocide, chooses to act with mercy. Her attendants, all women, no man is going to be an attendant to a princess going for a swim, stay silent. And somehow managed to not give away what's happened so that Moses is able to be raised safely. All of those women are the primary actors in that early part of Exodus. The men do very little. When they do show up, Moses does nothing but lie there. When they do show up, often they're puppets in God's hands. They're only doing what God has almost physically moved them to do. Even Moses and Pharaoh, that's sort of how they come on the scene. These women don't appear to have any instruction from God. They independently and creatively find ways to save the Hebrew people, to save Moses, which saves the Hebrew people, and to progress this whole story forward to enable what then becomes an adult story of men enacting the work of God. It's not only remarkable that Moses was brought to his role by a succession of creative women, brave and quick-thinking. But it's remarkable that even a hint of that is in our text. Now, I give that story as an, and I've leaned heavily on the work of Trevor Dennis, I have to acknowledge, whose book is over there. It actually belongs to me, so I can loan that one to you. This is not a standalone story in our Bible. There are many, many stories where there are women acting, moving the story forward, being people of God, who we don't see because we don't expect to see them. Which is why I encourage you to stand in a different place, to enter the text expecting to see them, and to question when you don't see them, and to step into it when you do. So to help with that, I'm going to give a little bit of context of the Bible times that women are in, just so you might get a sense of where the women might be or why they might not be there. Hopefully this will be not too long. The women appear in a myriad of roles and characters, from violently abused slaves through to imagery of God in the feminine. They're both rural and urban. They're elite and peasants. They're Jewish and they're foreigners. They're disciples, they're witnesses, they're quiet supporters. They're both wise and foolish, although surprisingly, they're very rarely painted as foolish. Unlike many of the men are painted as foolish. Some of them act against God's purposes, and Jezebel springs to mind, and others work for God's outcomes, and Rahab springs to mind. Many, many are victims. And Phyllis Tribble writes on some of the stories of the victim women. She writes particularly on the horrific story of the concubine who is sent as a penance out to the men who are trying to attack a guest and is gang raped and then cut up and taken to four quarters of the kingdom. And And she writes that, I'm sorry, I can't give you the reference for that. I know roughly where it is. She writes that, why is this story included? She says, so that the victim is not forgotten, that this woman who was so victimised and so abused in her time by her culture, that the story remains so that we may say, that is not right, when the people of her time did not. Which is an interesting perspective on why a victim's story might be in there. So I'm saying there is no women's perspective. There's no women's experience. There are many, many, many perspectives and experiences. Mostly the women appear as adjuncts to the stories of men, support roles for the activities and the plot lines of the men. But what if we read against the grain and place them as the subject of the story? We can do that. That's our choice. The Old Testament and the New Testament are 1,000 years and more apart, and it's two different cultures in lots of ways. In the Old Testament, wives, women are particularly depicted as wives and mothers, characterised by their sexuality, sexual partnership with men, and or their roles as mothers, although actually it's usually their role as wombs. Not much attention is given to their actual raising, mothering of children. What happens if we consider that? The mothering of Old Testament men and women. In Old Testament Jewish law, the women were largely non-people. The law was addressed to men. The women come into the law only if there's no man around, like if there's no male heirs, if they need special protection, like widows, where they're talking about sexual offences, or in some sexually differentiated roles, like laws regarding a female slave or a male slave. They're always subject to the authority of some man, usually a father, a husband or a brother. The only time Old Testament women are given honour and status in their own right is in their role as a mother. Which reflects an Old Testament society that is very family-oriented and very patriarchally family-oriented. Many of the laws are about establishing and maintaining the patriarchal family and the patrilineal descent line. It's very important that you know whose son, or who, it doesn't really matter whose daughter it is, but certainly whose son it is that's the next person. Most of the population are rural, probably 90%, but much of our Bible is urban, so we get a skewed perspective. Rural women are involved in the household and in subsistence work for the family, as urban women less so. Women are spoken of in lists of men's possessions. We've got 60 camels and 3 wives and whatever. But actually the law specifically prohibits buying and selling them. Which might not sound very radical now, but neighbouring cultures of the time didn't have a law prohibiting buying and selling women as wives. So that was quite unique to Hebrew times. There's a shift through the Old Testament from polygamy to monogamy. By the time of the prophets, prophets can use the image of God and Israelite society as the wife of God because it's a monogamous culture, so that makes sense. In earlier times, it wouldn't make sense because men were allowed to have, and often did have, many wives. Phyllis Bird says the women of the Old Testament are generally shown as intelligent, strong-willed and capable, and endowed with the gift of persuasion, which makes them potentially dangerous. Because they come out of their father's family into their husband's family, they maintain often a tie to their husband's family that can be used by that family to influence the family they've married into. Some of the professions of women in the Old Testament, wife and mother is the primary profession, which includes being primary producers and being responsible for children's education. But they're also prophets, practices of occult arts, professional mourners, midwives, nurses, prostitutes, singers or entertainers, and in their role as slaves, perfumers, bakers or cooks. So they're not just wives or mothers. We need to, which woman have you got in this story? The holiness laws meant women were often unclean, ritually unclean, especially during menstruation, that knocks out 1 week in 4, but also the result of their work of caring for children and the sick and cleaning the house, and they just were often ritually unclean. So there's actually no laws explicitly prohibiting them from religious life. It just in practice became nearly impossible to be involved. Miriam, the sister of Moses, is mentioned potentially serving in the temple alongside Aaron as another priest figure, but that sort of slips by the by. They also turn up in the Old Testament in the creation accounts, which are mythological tales. There's a very strong woman's voice in Song of Songs. Again, that's one of the few texts that potentially comes out of a woman's culture, a woman's voice. Proverbs uses women's imagery for wisdom and foolishness, and also perhaps for a divine character. I'm not going fast enough. In the New Testament, we've hit a Hellenized world. Greek culture has swept through the area, and this is where, if you're a rural Palestinian peasant, you're probably still leaning towards Old Testament structures for women's experience. If you're in the urban areas, and particularly much of our New Testament is written to Greek communities, then you've got much greater freedoms for women, including in marriage, property, employment. Women could run small businesses in Greek towns. They could be educated. In certain circumstances, they could file for divorce. Jesus stands out as truly remarkable for his egalitarian approach to gender. No other known teacher encourages female disciples to follow an itinerant lifestyle with him. Jesus doesn't reject the Jewish teaching on the centrality of family, and his divorce prohibitions even strengthen it, but he makes it second to the call to follow Jesus and to be active in the service of the family of the kingdom. Jesus allowed women, and especially Jewish women who are closer to the Old Testament model, unprecedented life choices, including staying single. This is unprecedented that you could choose that. Being the disciple of a great teacher, unprecedented. Travelling with Jesus and teaching men about matters of faith. And the New Testament church clearly had many, many roles for women, including in leadership and in independent service. Women are addressed in their own right in the New Testament letters, not as wife of or mother of. And yet, we know there is a tension in New Testament theology and New Testament practice. It appears that we have many communities wrestling with how to put into practice, in a real life situation, in a real patriarchal culture, Jesus' radical teaching on equality. And we end up with prohibitions. There's no need in the Old Testament to prohibit women teaching and preaching, because they couldn't do it anyway. The fact that the New Testament bothers to speak about it indicates that they were doing it and that it somehow threatens some social order of that community. I have some so what questions, reflections. I'm wondering if it's... I'll do my bit first and then I'll hear from you. Why do we do this? Why does this matter? As a woman, it's important for me to find stories that reflect my experiences and faces that look more like my own. But in many ways, the male characters have more in common with me than an ancient peasant woman does. And this is reflected. Friends of mine from Student Christian Movement who've been to regional conferences on women, the women who come out of the Asian contexts into SCM conferences, find their experience reflected in the Old Testament. They live in that patriarchal culture and they know those experiences. And those who come from Australia and New Zealand find it, it's foreign in the Bible, it's foreign there, it's a different thing. For men, I believe, and for women, it is important to recognise that the main narrative assumes a male perspective and that this is not universal. And that's not rocket science, but we just need to remember it. And we need to learn to hear other voices as relevant to male spirituality and experience, perhaps even to hear their resonance with aspects of yourself that are not the main narrative or the male narrative. To dialogue with Scripture and encounter God there, it can help to understand that Scripture is from a perspective, usually a male narrator, so we can stand aside from that perspective and free God to show us things. I don't know what things. Read and see. There are so many stories and perspectives. Be open to new things. Recognising women's stories and other stories at the margins that have not been emphasised in our tradition may also awaken us to the stories and voices in our own community that are being overlooked. Part of the reason the male voice so dominates our scripture is because the men were literate. We have men stand up in front here more often than women, not because we think they're more worthy to speak, but because more of the men in our community feel confident standing up to talk than the women. How can we listen to each other to ensure we hear and experience the wisdom within us that this medium doesn't work for? So I'm encouraging you all to prayerfully attempt to read Scripture standing in a different place and see what arises. They're listed as midwives to the Hebrew women, and it's ambiguous whether they were Egyptian or Hebrew. So there's two different ways to read it.
Do you have any thoughts about the little boys being circumcised? I'm just mentioning that.
No, but if you want a really wild and woolly story, find the story of Zipporah, which I didn't get to, in about Exodus 4, when God attacks Moses and threatens to kill him, and Zipporah circumcises possibly Moses and possibly their son. To appease God, it's a real kooky one.
Okay, anybody else?
No, I find that last comment about men being literate is very thoughtful, because basically it means everything in the Bible has been written by men, and of course we have the men's perspective, and it makes me think of what it would be like if women had written something. We've still got that problem around the world in other places where they're trying to achieve literacy for women, and it's still the same case. It's because they're not literate, women don't have a voice.
What I was going to read, and I was running out of time, is from Judges 5. There's a song of Deborah. The battle rejoicing cry after they've killed off Sisera, which is the story where Jael, the woman, drives a tent peg through the head of the commander who's sleeping in her tent, and then there's this lovely exultant battle cry. And at the very, sorry, my Bible didn't come up with me, it's gone into a small group, so it's not on my hand. At the very end of it, the voice has, Sisera and how he died, and we've all won, and then it says, she stands at the window watching for him to come home, Sisera's mother. And there's this little passage about how she is telling herself, oh, he's taking so long because he's gathering up the spoils of victory. And for me, that's a sense of what we get if we imagine ourselves into a woman's story instead of a man's story. Deborah is no less exultant about winning the battle, I just have to say. But she somehow remembers that even an enemy commander who has been oppressing her people has a mother.
Jesus encouraged women to follow him and to travel with him. I guess I'm wondering about the 12 apostles and why they were all there.
I don't know. But there are other women disciples and followers named. Joanna, Susanna, Salome, a couple of the Marys are named as followers, and also as people who, out of their means, support the work of Jesus. So they provide practical means, which means they're probably women who have some sort of independent income that are supporting his work. And that they're named suggests that after he was gone, they continued to be active in the Christian community. So although not named as one of the 12, but they were still somehow in leadership.
And Paul, just to clear you, when you said that, is the challenge for us is not only how we read the text that was largely written from patriarchy and by men, through the lens of 2,000 years of church history, which has also been interpreted significantly through the Old Testament. So that's an interesting thing. So even said that is, in fact, there are significant women in the Gospels, but 2,000 years of church history has taught us not to see them either.
Oh, sorry, Johnston.
I think it was a time of a time of arranged marriages, and we know that at least some of the disciples were married, so there's references to not to their wives but to their mothers and more, which raises the question of course, whether Jesus was married.
I don't have an opinion on that, except the previous time I got up here to speak, I talked about how Jesus comes from the social class that may have been so poor that he was unable to marry, because you had to have a certain amount of income to be able to take a wife, and he comes from the ranks that probably possibly couldn't.
Just thinking back to genealogy that I've already at that kind of level of ancestry, you could have just as easily written the genealogy from any woman, the wife of David, down to Mary, and then Mary to Jesus, and that would be a much more direct lineage, since Joseph actually didn't have any direct involvement with Jesus. It was just that realization that it was just a perspective of how people choose to.
And the genealogies are generally, my understanding is, they're not so much there as a factual list of drawing up your family tree as an indication of why we think this person is important. So what Michael was picking up, that a genealogy includes women and troublesome outsider women, indicates where we place this person as we start their story, on the margins, and shaped also by the history of women. The genealogy in the other gospel doesn't mention any women and traces it just to Joseph.
One point clear that we were in part A of this discussion, and Jesus on the crucifixion, he addressed the women. That was his, when his daughters in Jerusalem, so he gave them prominence.
And possibly it was only women left at the end. Having said that, male disciples found at the foot of the cross had a lot to lose. Women disciples found at the foot of the cross, they didn't have, if you haven't got much, you haven't got much to lose. So it was probably life-threatening for the disciples to be seen as followers of a publicly crucified person. It's just possibly not as life-threatening for the women to be publicly seen in that role. Although there were apparently prohibitions on things like mourning and words of comfort at a crucifixion, so they had to stay silent and at a distance.
Let's leave it there. Thanks, Claire.